that's been in the center of the FM dial for 62 years. Once again, and as always, thanks to listeners just like you. It's 9 a.m. in New York, and coming up next will be Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg.
Yes, Equal Rights and Justice. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and this is Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people, for another world is possible, and we are the ones to make it so. Later on, Miguel Mejia, falsely arrested for lewdness, and attorneys Marlon Bodden and Michelle Tuma finally bring an end to Port Authority police plainclothes sting operations targeting men they perceive as gay or gender nonconforming and arresting them at public urinals inside the Port Authority bus terminal. But first, captives. How Rikers Island took New York City hostage. I'm joined by Dr. Gerard Shanahan, professor of criminal justice, an expert on the history of the New York City jail system, and a critical scholar of policing and incarceration in the U.S. Also joining us for our discussion is my colleague from the Legal Aid Society, Marlon Bodden, who first encouraged me to pick up the book, Captives, How Rikers Island Took New York City Hostage. And thank you both for being with me this morning. Dr. Shanahan, how exactly, I mean, that's quite a name, Captives, How Rikers Island Took New York City Hostage. One of the things that is so critical about the book is that it is a comprehensive and contextual understanding of this horrific penal colony and how conceptually, financially, and otherwise it indeed has enveloped the politics and functioning of New York City. And please give us some of a rundown for that, because it's the first time that I've really seen an analysis of how we got to where we are with this particular penal colony, Rikers Island.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I think, like most historians, I admit that my preoccupation with my subject matter began in the present and looking around a sorry state of affairs in which a city like New York and the United States in general has a number of very pressing social problems attendant to poverty, structural racism, lack of public health, lack of meaningful and secure employment, and unfortunately the list could go on. And rather than taking these problems head on, our society is simply attacking their symptoms with the use of policing and incarceration. And, I mean, unfortunately, the mayoralty of Eric Adams, which came onto the scene after I had finished the book, really confirms the stubbornness of this law and order approach well into the 21st century. So I wanted to look back at the history, right? When I teach criminal justice to my students, I think one of the most important things that I try to do is denaturalize the world as we know it today, right? So we are born into this world and largely accept its premises. And so for young people who came of age in the final decades of the 20th century, it is just manifestly obvious that we live in a society where the vast majority of social problems in working class communities are dealt with by police. And it's totally natural to have millions of people locked up in jails and prisons. And so I set out to denaturalize Rikers, right? Rikers Island has not always existed as a penal colony. The vast majority of the island's ground surface hasn't always existed, right? That was constructed by prisoner labor in the early decades of the 20th century. And so in putting this history together, I really wanted to present the argument that nothing about how our society deals with social problems today is natural. It is the product of concrete struggle, class struggle, over the last century, and it is unfortunately a class struggle in which, at present, the working class is losing.
What I'd like to do, if I may, because the book itself, the writing is so crisp and engaging, is why don't we just take a moment, if you would be so kind, and to read a passage, and then we'll continue our discussion and ferret out the facts and the evolution and development of Rikers Island, which is really like the giant blob of horror movies of old that has absorbed and consumed New York politics to continue to exist. So why don't you give us a passage?
Sure. So I chose a passage that actually my publisher had to strong arm me into including, because I didn't want to make this book about me, right? But the fact is that in 2016, I did spend a month at the facility for sentenced men, the Eric M. Taylor Center. And that's what really motivated me to write this history. So I'm going to read a little bit about...
And by the way, when you say you spent a month there, you were arrested.
This wasn't
a sociological experiment.
No, I told them that I was a researcher, but they said I still had to stay the night. Yeah, so I was locked up there for a month. And this is not one of the meanest buildings on the island, right? This is the short stay facility for men, but I feel like I still got a sense of some of the basic problems that I wanted to explore in the book. And so let me just read from me recounting this kind of originary moment. Okay. So at Rikers, I beheld and experienced the degrading treatment to which tens of thousands of New Yorkers are subjected each year by guards who answer to nobody. Their behavior toward us prisoners under their watch ranged from callous indifference to aggressive hostility. It was not uncommon for a guard to shout threats and obscenities into a crowded room full of prisoners for no particular reason, aimed at nobody in particular. Rules were enforced arbitrarily, and the prisoner handbook enumerating our rights was confiscated as contraband. My visitors were berated and intimidated. They were subjected to invasive strip searches, as I was on a routine basis. My mail, a vital lifeline to the outside world, came in episodic spurts with no explanation. I also experienced the violence and humiliation of aggressive shakedowns by the island's emergency services unit, an elite band of warrior guards clad in ornate riot gear who tore through EMTC's dormitories with no explanation, dumping everyone's meager possessions on the floor, shouting abuse and threats. All the while, they sought to bait prisoners into a fight the prisoners would surely lose. On more typical days, discipline was maintained by verbal abuse and threats of time in the box, the island's expansive system of punitive solitary confinement, while the threat of violence remained just beneath the surface. Nevertheless, I was consistently reassured by just about everyone I spoke with that this was the calmest male facility on the entire island by a mile. This was a place for discarded people, where nobody cared if you lived or died. There was nothing to do but look at the calendar. Days were characterized by expansive idleness, waste, and enforced stupidity. The rapper Lil Wayne, who spent 8 months at EMTC in 2010, describes life there as days spent doing too much of effing nothing. I felt myself becoming meaner, jealously guarding my pitiful property, and increasingly courting conflict that I knew could end in disaster. One night, a prisoner experienced violent seizures, and a rookie guard sent out an emergency call. When his commander arrived, he ignored the prisoner and scolded the rookie for calling something as trifling as a prisoner's health crisis an emergency. My friend in the next bed over, who knew I was a writer, remarked, "Put that in your book. That man could have died. If he hadn't pulled the pin, they would have taken 20 minutes to come." So, of course, I had to put that in the book. In the exercise yard, I would do as many consecutive dips as possible, staring directly at the Empire State Building through four layers of razor wire fence and across the glimmer of the East River. All day, flights coming in and out of LaGuardia Airport buzzed overhead. From my dormitory window, I could see planes taking off and landing, and the steady stream of traffic across the mile-long bridge connecting the island to Queens. Conversations buzzed about New York streets, to which all of us would soon return, and the new arrivals streamed in on a nearly daily basis, bringing with them their own unique stories of misadventures in the city's behemoth punishment system. And I'll wrap it up with one more paragraph. One day I was staring longingly at the skyscrapers of Midtown Manhattan, doing my best to recount what life looked like outside of their ground floors. And mind you, this is the last place on earth that I'd want to be if I were free. Then it struck me. Where I was standing was not only just as central to New York City as Times Square. It was, in fact, Times Square's necessary opposite. Rikers absorbs the symptoms of social problems the city is unwilling to address at their root. Among the populations who resist the imperatives to work for a wage, offend public order, or else simply refuse to leave when the ruling class wants its neighborhood back. Just as one overturns a log and observes the bugs that enrich the soil, if you turn over the sanitized spectacles of contemporary Times Square or Williamsburg or the Lower East Side or Long Island City and all the rest, you see Rikers.
And we are listening to a passage read by Gerard Shanahan from Captives, How Rikers Island Took New York City Hostage. And I just want to bring Marlon Bodden into the discussion, who first alerted me to this important book, and also because she happens to be a Legal Aid Society attorney. And I was wondering, Marlon, what your thoughts were and what you would like to put to Dr. Gerard Shanahan after the reading of that passage. And thank you for joining me this morning.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mimi, for having me on. And yes, I when I first heard about this book, Captives, I was really happy because this is the first time that it seemed to me that somebody was actually getting to the root of the problem in New York, which is, you know, almost many of us want Rikers closed down completely. And what we want is alternatives to incarceration. Given that so many people who end up on Rikers have medical issues, mental health issues, they are unhoused, etc. So we think that the great majority of people should not be in jail at all. And so we need to find alternatives to incarceration, not build new shiny jails, which is one of the main points made in Captives. But I also would like to ask Dr. Shanahan a question about why he says in Captives that reforming jails is nearly impossible under our current system. Why is that?
That's a great question. And so, in case the listener isn't aware, the major political context of this book was the debate between 2017 and 2019 over whether to close Rikers Island and replace it with this series of new jails throughout the city. And this began as a campaign to simply close Rikers Island, and then a series of well-funded nonprofit organizations provided a complex model for constructing skyscraper jails in every borough to replace Rikers. And so I learned as much as I could about this new jail construction plan. These were going to be some of the, if not the tallest, jails in the world, which is really remarkable. And so the more I learned about this new plan for new jails on Rikers, and I was reading about all this stuff at the same time as I was doing the research for Captives, the more I realized how similar the arguments that the 21st century reformers were making to the arguments that the 20th century reformers were making about the necessity for building jails on Rikers Island. You know, we take for granted today that Rikers is this terrible place. But if you read what jail reformers were saying in the mid-20th century, they imagined that Rikers Island would be a modern, humane, progressive, penological stronghold that would be the envy of progressive prison administrators all over the world. You know, a lot of the problems of the Women's House of Detention, for instance, in Greenwich Village, were attributed to the fact that it was a skyscraper. And the Department of Correction welcomed the opportunity to open up a sprawling horizontal jail on Rikers Island to take its place. And they argued that this would mitigate a lot of the misery of just being crammed into this skyscraper in Greenwich Village. And so the more I read from the body of writing by the reformers, the more it occurred to me that these are very well-meaning and intelligent people who are operating within a very narrow framework. They really believe that the problems that you encounter in a jail can be solved by interventions at the level of the jail. Building facilities with more windows, painting the walls certain colors. There's an immense amount of literature around pastel colors and the effects of pastel colors on mitigating violence. And I think that reformers have certainly created facilities that are less miserable to inhabit on a day-to-day basis in a lot of places. I mean, I would rather, you know, if I had to choose, be locked up in the tombs of today than the tombs of the 70s and certainly the tombs of the 1870s. But you can never solve the problems that bubble up in the jail by simply intervening on the level of the jail itself. These are the symptoms of larger social problems that exist in the broader social fabric. And I really wanted that to be the primary intervention of Captives, because the way that we talk about social institutions in places in New York City is that every institution has its own set of problems, and that's the expert domain of a small set of experts in particular nonprofits and city agencies and so on. But unfortunately, the problems of the jail are the problems of the broader society, and they cannot be fixed there. They can only be fixed at the broader social level.
Well, you certainly, in the book, make it clear that Rikers is really the triumph of neoliberalism culminating in mass incarceration. I want to get to another point that you also raise, which is quite striking, and that is, and it's a key point of your expose, in effect, your exploration of the torture chamber that is Rikers and the city jails, which takes us to the interplay or duel, if you will, between the guards and management. And how does that play out and create an atmosphere of torture and an inevitability, if you will, that the environs will be torturous and unproductive to any kind of social reform in the final analysis?
That's a great question. The more I learned about Rikers, the more I realized that its history is very much a labor history. And a reviewer of the book, this guy, Brendan O'Connor, recently pointed this out. He said it in those terms, and I said, wow, I couldn't have said it better myself, Mr. O'Connor. It's a history of the struggle between a large workforce of guards who come from working class communities, and by the end of the 20th century, they're the vast majority of them are black and brown. It's a struggle between those guards and their management, their uniformed management, in some cases, and certainly their civilian management. And so, in a lot of ways, it's actually a very common story. And I was when I was locked up there, I was visited by a friend of mine, the late historian Noel Ignatieff, who used to work in steel plants in the Chicago area, and he wrote a lot about his experiences doing rank and file organizing. I was telling him how the facility was run and how basically there's all kinds of impossible rules that don't make any sense, and the management is inept, and they're just running around putting out fires, and the guards basically do whatever they want as long as the managers aren't over their shoulder, and the prisoners actually have a very active role in keeping the whole place going. And if the guards came in one day and decided to follow all the rules as they were written down on paper, the place would come to a screeching halt. And Noel said, yeah, that sounds exactly like U.S. Steel. And so in a lot of ways, it's a very kind of common story of a large working class workforce thrown together in this kind of combination, right, that Marx predicted would create all kinds of wonderful liberatory possibilities, struggling with their bosses, trying to carve out control over the conditions of their labor, trying to carve out what we might call autonomy in how they live and how they work. But the only key difference, right, and this is, I really want to emphasize this, the key difference is the human beings are the material at Rikers. They're not, it's not iron or steel or automobiles, right? This is a large working class workforce overseeing violence against human beings. And so in my experiences with guards and with based on everything that I've read, these are remarkably ordinary people. They're interested in a very narrow set of objectives, right? They want to find a well-paying job with good benefits. They come from communities that are hemmed in by enduring structural racism, segregation, the frustrated opportunities for upward mobility. And these guards basically select from a very narrow set of options the best possible path to carve out a secure life for themselves. And unfortunately, they do a job that simply should not exist. It is a job that compels them to oversee violence and dehumanization against other working class New Yorkers, often from the same backgrounds and even from the same neighborhoods that they come from. And this process changes them, right? And so central to Captives, I think, is the story of how these guards constituted a powerful political force pushing against the dignity and the safety of the people that they guarded. And were actually quite successful in imposing their will on Rikers Island. And, I mean, if we even look today to the chaos in Rikers, the supposed chaos, right? Anybody who's monitoring the situation closely knows what's going on. The guards are creating this appearance of disorder and chaos because they want to keep the jails on Rikers, and they want more hires, even though there's now far more guards than prisoners in the New York system. And so this is a long history that unfortunately continues to the present day. But I really want to emphasize that its origins are actually a very common story in American labor history.
Well, also, I must say that every time I read anything about the prison, the jail system, and certainly your books as well, and particularly with the name Captives, I can't help but think about the labor relations as the people who are incarcerated as chattel, essentially, in a plantation context. And the guards are inherently the overseers who career-wise aspire to the more developed and higher-paid managerial positions. And that formulation of the captive and treating people as chattel, the commodification of people who are incarcerated, inherently... There's nothing that can be reformed. It always must degenerate, regardless of the color of the walls or the cleanliness of the tiles. It must degenerate into a position where you are humiliating, dehumanizing, and neutralizing the human potential. Isn't that really the problem of Rikers Island?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the main problem of Rikers Island is not that there's anything uniquely evil about the island, right? And this is kind of a bête noire for me. A lot of activists like to say, "Oh, Rikers, you know, Rikers Island is named after this real bad guy, Richard Riker," as if that proves anything. First of all, it's not named after Richard Riker. He was a 19th century judge who was implicated in the capture of accused runaway slaves, and a lot of whom weren't, actually. So he's a real bad dude, right? But a lot of contemporary activists say, no, Rikers was named after this really bad guy, as if that explains anything. And it actually doesn't. Rikers could have been named after Abraham Lincoln or Harriet Tubman, and the presence of human cages on Rikers would still make it an evil place. And I really want to emphasize that. There's nothing ontologically evil about the soil of Rikers Island. I got a great question recently when I went on the It's Going Down podcast, when they asked me, in writing a book about Rikers in particular, did I risk making it into an exception, saying that there's something exceptionally bad about this one place, right, and we need to pay a special attention to it versus all of the other forms of human caging in the United States. And I thought that was a fantastic question because it actually is a risk. I really want to emphasize this to your listeners. The only thing that makes Rikers Island an evil place is that there's human cages on it.
Marlon, I want to give you the last opportunity since, again, you are the one who acquainted me with this book and had such passion about it that you put out an email immediately and said, colleagues, colleagues, we've got to read Captives, How Rikers Island Took New York City Hostage. I want you to ask the final question of our guest, Dr. Gerard Shanahan, and then Dr. Shanahan, what is to be done? Marlon?
So the federal government, that is the U.S. Attorney's Office, of course, has asked the court in the Nunez consent decree to have a receivership appointed. And I know you've talked about this, Dr. Shanahan. Please tell us why this is not going to solve the problem.
Well, I don't mean to just be a naysayer. I have a lot of respect for the people who are working on a daily basis to try and mitigate the suffering in places like Rikers Island. And so I don't think it's a foolish idea, but if you look at the history, the federal government through the federal judiciary has actually been involved in a fairly direct way in Rikers Island and the New York City jail system since the early 1970s. And if you look at the way, for instance, the New York City jail system responded to the various lawsuits and consent decrees of the 1970s and 1980s, you will get a sense of how little power the federal government actually has when the guards dig in their heels and when the Department of Correction follows suit. And just to be clear, the Department of Correction, the civilian administration, typically does everything in its power to make the guards happy because they have probably more power over their workplace than just about any workers in the United States right now. And so I think it feels like a panacea that's simply not going to work. There's a lot of precedent in history, especially recent history, of all kinds of outside overseers being put in charge of, you know, reforming Rikers and reporting on the horrors in Rikers, and it's produced mountains of reports, and it's produced all kinds of directives, and I've read a lot of these reports, and nothing really ever comes of them, precisely because the guards are simply too powerful. And the reason why the guards are so powerful, and we didn't really get to this just because we had so much to talk about, is because the guards, just like the New York police, they represent the predominant power block in New York City politics right now, which is the finance, insurance, real estate sector governing the city for pure profit extraction. There is no greater good in New York City politics right now than simply private industry making as much money as possible. And this is actually why I begrudgingly admire Mayor Eric Adams, because whereas someone like de Blasio would never say that, he would say, of course, we believe in truth and justice and freedom. And Eric Adams will just come out and say, yes, I believe that the purpose of government is to, you know, make the market optimal for investors, right? He's mm-hmm. wonderfully honest like that. It reminds me of Bloomberg. And so the guards actually play an important role in this order of things in New York. They represent the domination of New York City by brute force at the behest of private capital.
Well, much more to talk about. We will continue because the issue of Rikers is so important, and frankly, I am aggressively a prison abolitionist, but I so strongly want to recommend that people read Captives, How Rikers Island Took New York City Hostage, how conceptually and otherwise financially it is enveloped and controls the politic. Gerard Shanahan really delivers an urgent intervention into our national discussion about the future of mass incarceration and the call to abolish prisons. The contentious debate about the future of Rikers Island penal colony rolls onward, and Captives is a must-read for anyone interested in the island and what it represents. I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll have you back, and we'll continue this discussion because we have to probe deep and hard in order to wind up at the point where we, yes, abolish the caging of human beings. Dr. Gerard Shanahan, thank you for your work.
And thank you very much for having me. Please keep up the good work.
Great. And Marlon's going to stay with us, and we're going to get on our next guest to talk about the issues of police stings and a real limitation now, given the great work of people like Marlon, to prevent them from the harassment and intrusion of our bodily functions and our sense of self. Phil Collins, True Colors, and I'd like to welcome to our broadcast the courageous and outraged plaintiff, Miguel Mejia, who decided to fight back rather than get back after being falsely arrested for lewdness. And Legal Aid Society attorney stays with us, Marlon Bodden. And we're also joined by Michelle Tuma with Winston and Strawn, who together finally have brought an end to Port Authority police plainclothes sting operations targeting men they perceive as gay or gender nonconforming and arresting them at public urinals inside the Port Authority bus terminal. And I'm outraged, and I've been outraged for years watching homeless youth, watching trans people, gay people who have been mercilessly harassed, performing their bodily functions in public toilets. So with that, yeah, it's a critical issue. Miguel, thank you so much for being with us. And maybe you can set the stage for us. What happened to you and why did you decide to fight back, as I said, rather than get back? And it's great to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me on. So on a warm, very hot day, I was on my way to New Jersey to visit a friend for a tattoo, and, you know, he asked me to pick up some artwork for him. I lived at the time downtown, and so it was convenient for me to pick it up and take it to him. I had been out all day. I had gone to the gym, run some errands, and then, you know, at like 4:30, 4:45, I got out of the train and walked up at Port Authority bus terminal, and I found the bathroom, and I, you know, I had the artwork, I had my gym bag, and I, you know, proceeded to pee because I knew I had a long trip over to New Jersey. And so as I'm peeing, you know, someone stood next, I was in the second to last stall. That was the only space available. It was rush hour. And so, you know, I felt as if someone was watching me or looking at me. And so when I look over, the gentleman next to me, you know, smiled or smirked. And, you know, I continued to be whatever, you know, another weirdo in New York City, not a big deal. And so he left, and then I washed my hands. And then as I walked away and walked out of the bathroom, you know, I proceeded to walk towards the stairs because I was on the second floor. And someone taps me on, you know, I had my headphones on. That's what was important to know because I was oblivious to what was going on around me. And so, you know, I get tapped on the shoulder and I turn around and it's like four cops. And I know that they're cops at this moment because they're showing me their badges and they're, you know, they're signaling, they're talking. So I pull out my headphones and they're saying, you're under arrest, you know, and I'm like, for what? And they continue to say, you're under arrest. You know exactly what you did. And I'm like, no, I don't know what I did. What is this about? And I'm not resisting arrest, but I didn't know why I was being arrested. So I acted as if they totally made a mistake. And so, you know, they grabbed my arm and they handcuffed me. Basically, they took off my bag and they took the artwork and they handcuffed me and then proceeded to walk me through the entire Port Authority over to a precinct that happens to be in there that I never even knew existed. They handcuffed me to a bench, you know, almost immediately from when you walk in, there are benches. It's like a bar with like these little pieces of plastic. And I guess once you go to sit on them, they become like a bench of sorts. So they handcuffed me there, you know, and I'm like, but why am I, you know, what happened? What did I do? You know, why am I here? And no one wants to talk to me. No one wants to give me any explanation. Time goes by. I must have sat there for about 30, 40 minutes. And then eventually they put me in a cell. They take my shoelaces. They put everything that I had, jewelry-wise and stuff like that, in a manila envelope, you know, and I continuously ask, what am I here for? Like, what is this about? You know, I'm thinking maybe they mistook me for someone else or whatever, but, you know, it would have been nice to be told. So anyway, they put me in a cell, and every time, but I was kind of away from everything at this point, and every time that one of the police officers, whether plainclothes or, you know, or in uniform comes in, I'm like, you know, can someone tell me what's going on? Why am I here? And no one is giving me any information. As maybe 2-3 hours pass, and then one of the officers that was part of the team that arrested me comes in, and, you know, I ask him if I can make a phone call. He's like, well, I have to take your fingerprints and I have to take your pictures. I'm like, can you tell me what this is about? He's like, well, you know, you'll find out. That's the only information that I got from them. He took my picture. He took my fingerprints. Later on, he allowed me to, you know, he went into my envelope and got my phone so that I can make a phone call, which I did. Because, again, at this point, your mind is racing. You don't know what is going on. Why are you there? You know, what did you do? And you know, all these scenarios pop into your head. How do you explain this? How do you justify this to yourself, let alone to anyone else? Anyway, I never got any information. After being there for about almost 5 hours, they took me out. And they walked me over to the bench, and the sergeant gives me a piece of paper, and he told me, you know, make sure you show up on this date to court. But I'm thinking of summons, or they figured out, you know, that I'm not who they thought I was, or whatever. Anyway, they didn't mind. I had all these things to do, and, you know, I had to make sure that this artwork gets to my friend because he was leaving town the next day. So I said, listen, no matter what, I'm going to take you this. I said, even if what we planned can't happen because now it's like 9:30 at night. Anyway, long story short, I end up going to court on the date that was there. And, you know, in my mind, having grown up in New York City, you know, and of course, as I, when I was younger, I hopped the train and I got a summons and I showed up to court, paid the fine. And, you know, it was nothing. It was like no big deal. That was what in my mind was to happen. But when I get to court and, you know, and they assign me the lawyer from Legal Aid, she explained to me what I was being charged with was absolutely nothing that I would have ever imagined or thought of. Because
and that was what were you charged with?
They had charged me with public lewdness, which details me pleasuring myself for over 5 minutes in the bathroom at rush hour in Port Authority in New York City, which was ridiculous to me. That being said, I said, absolutely, that's not what happened. I explained to her exactly what happened. And then, you know, she's like, okay, so what would you like to do? You know, we ended up, you know, she did what she did on the legal side. And then, you know, we fought the case. I definitely decided to fight the case.
Well, let me also bring Marlon Bodden and Michelle Tuma into this discussion. So how do we translate what happened to Miguel into a commonality for lots of people, certainly with tremendous homophobic overtures and so on? How does this become translated into a violation of someone's rights? And talk about the nature of the litigation, which is quite momentous in its recent settlement, the Holden litigation, as it's called, after one of the other litigants. Marlon, why don't you start us there, and Michelle, add. Michelle? Or Marlon?
Marlon. Yeah, Marlon, are you there?
Marlon? Well, we may have dropped Marlon. Let's continue with Michelle. And yeah, we are speaking with Michelle Tuma.
Sure, no problem. So this is actually part of a pattern that we've seen from, I think, not just Port Authority, but other police departments, where there is this targeting of a specific community. But with respect to the Port Authority and public restrooms in particular, we've seen this pattern reaching back into the early 2000s. There's a case called Martinez in which the Port Authority had to pay out a huge settlement because their officers were doing exactly what you just heard was done to Miguel. They would go into public restrooms in plain clothes and wait for men that they viewed as, you know, other, right? So men that were not gender conforming or might have been gay, or they had no basis for this besides their appearance. And they would approach them and they would do exactly what you heard Miguel say. These men were arrested falsely, and they knew they do this because in our view, they do this because they recognize that it's such an embarrassing offense that they can get away with it. Because lots of people, and we had the same problem when we were litigating the Holden case, this happened to so many people. It was not just Miguel, but many people do not have the desire to go to court and fight it, right? They'd rather just pay a fine or settle out of court or figure something out so that they don't have to face this. So to find a plaintiff like Miguel who's willing to stand up and say, what you did to me was wrong, is what we needed in order to get them to stop this. So that's why it was so important that he really stepped up and took this as far as he has. But back to the pattern and practice. So it happened in 2000. It's on the record. It's in the courts. They had to pay quite a substantial sum to that plaintiff. And then in 2014, this is what Marlon and Molly and Legal Aid Society had noticed, is that they were noticing a pattern again of a lot of their clients having the same thing happen to them again, specifically in the Port Authority bus terminal. Through litigation and discovery, we were able to determine that, based on the police reports we received from the Port Authority, that there was a huge spike in 2014 in the summer. So exactly like Miguel described, it's warm, people are trying to get through things quickly, and there was a huge spike in public lewdness arrests and public masturbation arrests only, right? Like, they were seeing no spikes in other kinds of, like, drug offenses or anything, just in that specific area of crime. And it also followed a really strange pattern, right? It was not like a natural, you know, crime has, you know, different patterns and things change, statistics change. But this particular crime or pattern was very strange because it would happen during rush hour, which is not an intuitive time you would think something like this happens. You would think empty restrooms, this could happen if you know, but not in the middle of rush hour, not the demographic of people that they were arresting. And also it was only just a few officers. So it became clear to us that this was just a tactic to get their arrests up. It's the easy way to do it. It's an embarrassing offense. And they weren't going to get a lot of pushback until, you know, Miguel and our other plaintiffs stepped up and said, no, this is enough.
And let's see if we also have Marlon back with us again. Marlon?
Yes, I did. Sorry. My phone shut off. I apologize.
Ah. So if you could also pick up on some of the things that Michelle Tuma was saying, the politics behind this that translated into the litigation that became known as the Holden litigation, and that is Holden versus the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey.
Yes. So this is because this is LGBTQ plus Pride Month. This is really important that we, our clients settled their case against the Port Authority actually on May 31st through June 1st. So I want to acknowledge that. And so you're absolutely right. The politics about this case, they really have their roots in the history of anti-LGBTQ politics in New York City. And actually throughout the country, going back for many, many years, but in particular the 60s and the 70s. And so today, what the Port Authority did was, in this case, in the Holden case, is they recreated those horrible arrests where they historically, the police targeted LGBTQ plus people, to accuse them of public lewdness and exposure of the person. And it's something that we had hoped was in the past, but it resurfaced amongst our clients in our criminal defense practice, where our attorneys at the forefront of this this work, of our public defenders, they were the ones to first notice this pattern. So, yes, this is a political issue that has been going on for a long time, and this is why the settlement has secured historic reforms to the Port Authority's, the police department's discriminatory practices targeting LGBTQ plus people.
And we're going to get to that in a minute, because they really are some important, critical reforms. Miguel, you were the one who, of course, had the most to sacrifice. And as I started to say, you were both courageous and you were outraged. How do you understand the offense and the politics behind the kind of harassment that you experienced? What did this suit mean to you?
Well, as Michelle and Marlon said, I was probably going to be one of those people who is not going to fight this, because at the end of the day, who goes against the police? You know, what they said is usually, you know, their word is usually going to win over anyone. At least that's what I was under the impression of. But once I realized what this entailed and what this would do to me in my life, in terms of not being able to be employed in the public sector or in almost any sector, because I would have probably had to register as a sex offender when that was, you know, so far from the truth, it's ridiculous. So what it meant to me is, aside from what had happened to me, the fact that this had been happening on a regular basis, and luckily the appointed original lawyer for my trial happens to have been a supervisor, and so she had already some idea based on, you know, the word being that this was a regular occurrence amongst, you know, legal aid, you know, clients, then I became outraged. I absolutely became outraged. You know, I was completely taken aback that this was happening on a regular basis. I just thought that this was, you know, a case of mistaken identity until I realized what exactly it was that they were accusing me of. And again, in rush hour at 5 o'clock pre-pandemic in Port Authority, where there was a line to be able to get in and out of that bathroom, it's impossible for anyone to be doing anything other than taking care of their business and moving it out. You know, that's just crazy to me. So when that came about and I realized that this was happening on a regular basis, I decided to fight it, because it's not right that the police department, who's supposed to protect us, is, you know, doing things to that is just illegal, basically.
Mm. So let's, given the time constraints that we have, talk about, and let's start with you, Marlon, and then Michelle Tuma. What actually were the settlements? And this was, by the way, a long fight. It went on for years. And I must say that it was the energy and perseverance of Miguel that in many ways kept it going. And of course, people have enormous stake in this, as Miguel was saying, their career, their employment possibilities, and certainly the dehumanization of the level of harassment is foremost, and the violation of people's really elementary human and civil rights. So, Marlon, what are some of the highlights that now have been put in effect due to this courageous stance of Mr. Holden and Miguel Mejia?
So, actually, if you don't mind, I'd like Michelle to take this question.
Absolutely.
Sure, no problem. So, as you're saying, it was a long fight, so the litigation went on for years, but just settlement negotiations alone lasted about two via Skype, so that was quite a process. But in the end, we really focused on a set of reforms that LGBTQ community members and groups wanted us to push forward. So we met with them before we entered settlement negotiations with the Port Authority and came up with a list of things that they thought would also be helpful for the community. So number one, with like an exclamation point, was having the Port Authority end the plainclothes patrols of restrooms for these crimes in particular. So we got a statement from them that they have stopped doing this, and that if they ever are going to do plainclothes policing in the restrooms again, it's going to require the highest senior level of Port Authority sign-off for those kind of patrols. Because what we saw happening was these junior officers who had no training in plain clothes, no training, very little training, period, go and do these kind of patrols, and then this would lead to false arrests. So the second reform we have is Port Authority is going to be designating a high-ranking Port Authority police officer as the chief of agency affairs. And this is meant to be a point of contact for the LGBTQ community members, but also other community members, too. So this is supposed to be, like, if you are noticing that your community is being targeted or discriminated against or some, that kind of nature, there's a point within Port Authority, because we recognize that it is a big bureaucracy, right? It's overseeing multiple you know, ports, airports, bridges, tunnels, you name it, over two states. So we wanted them to have a point at which these communities would have, like, a face to direct their, you know, their complaints and their concerns about. So that was number two. Number three was updating their policies, right? So during discovery, we've got so many of their internal policies and training manuals and things like that. And us and our experts were just pretty appalled at, like, the old, outdated language that was used in their training manuals. Like, the fact that we're training police officers on manuals that use terminology that's not appropriate or relevant anymore was just kind of shocking.
And I do have to just say that it's 9:58, and we have about 30 seconds more to perhaps summarize. So,
okay, great. I can do that really quick. So we also got training. We got additional training for new officers on non-discrimination of LGBTQ folks. We got single stall restroom signs, and they're updating their complaint form so that it's tracking when people from this community in particular have complaints or concerns.
And I want to give Miguel the last word here. Aside from the fact that the plaintiffs got damages of some amount, the issue of dignity is, of course, critical importance. So what did you get out of this settlement?
I went into this settlement into wanting to pursue this for the change and the fact that, or not the fact, but basically so that this never happens to someone again who wasn't exactly doing what they're being accused of. If someone is doing that, then by all means, they should arrest them or whatever. But for someone who innocently goes into the bathroom for this to be happening simply because they didn't like how you looked or what you wore or how you walked or whatever the case may be, that is absolutely not right. We are Americans. This is America.
Okay.
You're supposed to protect.